And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my honor to welcome Jacqueline Woodson to the program today. Ms. Woodson is one of America's most talented and beloved poets and authors of fiction for children. She's won the National Book Award, a Coretta Scott King Award, and numerous other accolades, including currently serving as the Youth Poet Laureate for the Poetry Foundation. 2016 sees the publication of her first novel for adults in 20 years. It's called Another Brooklyn, and it's published by Amistad. Jacqueline, it's been quite a while since you had a published novel aimed at the adult market. What prompted you to write Another Brooklyn?
I think a couple of things. One is I feel like when I started writing for young people, there was definitely this hole in the body of literature that I wanted to fill, and that was books that were written by and about people who look like me. And I wrote a lot of books. And then when Brown Girl Dreaming got so much attention and finally won the National Book Award and a Newbery Honor and the Coretta Scott King, I thought, I can step away for a while and try something new. And I always like to push boundaries as a writer. So I didn't want to do the same thing again. I had written a memoir in verse. I had written a novel in verse. I had written a narrative. So I wanted to try to see what else I was able to do.
And having won so many awards before and been a finalist three times before, what was it like when you finally won the National Book Award?
It never gets old, even to be a finalist. I was surprised. I was really surprised. And when Sharon Draper said that it had been a unanimous decision, I still didn't know that it was me who was winning. But I definitely, when she said my name, I was still surprised and quite happy.
And to hear from a fellow great writer like Sharon Draper is incredible, too.
Yeah, she's amazing. I love everything she writes.
Now, you talked about writing in these different styles. Another Brooklyn does have kind of a lot of poetic sensibility to it. Mm-hmm. So how does your prose writing differ from your poetry, your poesy?
I think with poetry, it's definitely much more intentional. And with the narrative, I'm more concerned with story. And so with Another Brooklyn, I wanted to marry the two and really pay close attention to both the language and the story and have both of them really balance each other and also intersect in this way that made the whole narrative very intentional. So I tried to stay away from lots of adjectives. I tried to make each sentence almost stand on its own, but work well within the narrative. I used white space in a different way than I've used in other books that are narratives. And I really, again, even with everything I read it out loud to see how it sounds and then want to see how it looks on the page. So there was a lot more of that with Another Brooklyn.
And with it being a relatively brief novel, I'm guessing, what, about 30,000 words maybe, somewhere in that area?
I don't know how to count words. I definitely know page counts. But
it seems like it would take a lot of work to get it trimmed and pared and just so.
Yeah, it's pretty taut. And it was a lot of rewriting, a lot of rereading out loud to see where I could pare it down, to see, again, too, where the narrative was going and was I taking any extra steps to get there. So there were scenes that went away. There were definitely lots of words that went away. And even some of the ways I was developing the character, I changed it to make it more of a straight narrative. And that's the only way it's a straight narrative. We see almost that hero's journey of August going from the ordinary world. She has a couple of ordinary worlds. There are a lot of Another Brooklyns in the book. So we have the world of Tennessee, and then we have her world in Brooklyn. And her world in Brooklyn starts out as that tiny window on the third floor with her little brother. Then it becomes the gate, and inside the gate, and then it becomes the neighborhood. It starts out with her brother, and then it becomes her friends. So you see her traverse all these different worlds, but in the narrative, there is still, she goes from her ordinary world into this other place, and then she comes back home to what is now changed, right? Wiser than when she left.
So much of the sections kind of seem impressionistic. I'm guessing that the story is told with August from an adult perspective, looking back at her youth.
She comes back home for her dad's funeral and then meets a childhood friend on the train. And then it kind of throws her back into her teenage years. And that's one thing that's different than writing for young people, right? With young people, you're in that moment of their childhood or young adulthood. And with writing from an adult perspective, you can go back into those moments, but now you're looking at it from this adult perspective, which is what August is doing with it. She's looking at herself as a young person through this adult gaze.
And how much do you think that differs from how she felt when she was going through these events the first time?
I think the way we all feel, she says it in the book, she's like, it's not the moment, it's the memory, right? So when you're in the moment, you're not aware that the moment you're in is one day going to be a memory because you're so in it. Even as you're in it, it's becoming memory, right? This moment has just passed us. But you're not aware because you're a young person. And when you're young, there's a way that I think we feel very immortal. And then as an adult, especially an adult like August, who has made a career out of studying the rituals of death and dying, she has a deeper sense of what it means to be in the moment.
And you mentioned that window. She's first looking out at Brooklyn when they moved there from Tennessee. Do you think it's that observation style she had looking at that window that led her to be an anthropologist?
No, I think what led her to be an anthropologist was what happened with her mother and her not being able to, as a young person, come out of the denial of that. And early in the book, I talk about one of the rituals where the people have their dead and they keep them with them and they love them deeply. They dress them every day. They take them on trips until they have enough money to bury them. But until they have raised that money to bury them, they don't consider them dead. And that was what was going on with August, that she had to get to a point where she could deal with the fact of what happened to her mother.
And it seems denial was a family tradition because her mother had such a hard time accepting that her brother had died in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people were stunned by the impact of Vietnam in real life and in a lot of fiction. And I think for her mother to lose her only brother, I think there was also the denial around the land. You know, the government took the land away because they didn't know how to run it and they didn't know how to pay taxes and own something. And then her father, who's this very present and protective person in the world, is the one that's, for me, very much in the world. And August is kind of back in Tennessee, and Tennessee is her promised land.
Because talk about a culture shift coming from rural Tennessee, bucolic land, to Brooklyn of the early 70s, which was such an exciting but also kind of a dangerous time, too.
It depends on the gaze in terms of dangerous, and I think that's what I was trying to get at, in that when people were looking at Brooklyn from the outside, it felt dangerous to the other. But for the people living inside it, even with all this going on and the danger of their everyday life, it was this place that was also home and very protective of them. And the girls protected each other in this way as best they could. But of course, in the case of Another Brooklyn, Bushwick on the page is a real place. It's the place I grew up. And it's a place that has changed drastically from the 1970s to now.
Because it's now like a very Dominican type neighborhood, isn't it now?
Now it's hipster.
Oh, it's Williamsburg adjacent, I guess?
Yeah. What happened was when people started getting pushed out of Williamsburg, they moved to Bushwick, and then Bushwick became this hipster place. I think it was Leonard Lopate. Not Leonard Lopate. I forget who the other person is on NPR. But he was interviewing someone about tequila, and he called it the Bushwick of tequila, you know, because it was this kind of hipster small batch brand. And Bushwick is that. When I was growing up there, it was on the edge of white flight. Like I talk about in the book, the white people were moving to Long Island and upstate New York and Westchester, and Black and Latino people were moving in through the Great Migration when people were escaping the repressive, oppressive conditions of the South or the North, and people were immigrating for the American dream. So it was a predominantly Black and Latino place. Now the block that the house where I grew up in, that block is probably half white again. And the people who came to New York and were able to stay are the other part of the homeowners there. And I think it's important that people know the histories of their neighborhood. So when I was writing the book, I wanted to put Bushwick as a real place on the page, as how it existed in the 70s and the late 60s, with the blackout, with the essence of Son of Sam around them, with all the stuff that was going on, and then take that real place as it existed for real and then create a narrative around it, which is the story of the girl. And part of that was also growing up and having people look at it from the outside as this thing that was dangerous and all these things. I kind of wanted to let people know that there was another kind of thing going on for the people who lived there. I mean, for me, I get nervous in Tennessee. You know, this is a very other place for me. But I think for people on the outside, any place that's other has its pros and cons that way.
Well, why did you choose Tennessee as her origin in particular?
I had grown up in South Carolina. I had written Brown Girl Dreaming, and that was a memoir. And South Carolina is easy for me, right? I could just mine the South Carolina of my childhood and gather from there. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to stretch myself a little bit, and I wanted to set it in a place that I didn't know, so I would have to research it, and I would have to come to understand what it meant to live there. And I liked the landscape of it. I wanted to use that. So that's why Tennessee.
Gigi is from South Carolina, one of her friends.
Yeah, her mother is. So we don't see her that much. And then Sylvia's from Martinique, which is another place that was interesting to me.
Like the young women in the book, you were born in the mid-60s. Are there any other particular biographical similarities?
Well, Bushwick, right? Sure. So, and I had good friends. I still had, like, my friend Maria, who you meet in Brown Girl Dreaming. She and I are still very close. That essence of friendship, that essence of the adolescent friendship was very true for me, and the importance of it. You know, I have a younger brother and an older sister, and so I know what it is like to have a younger brother that you adore deeply. I mean, I adore my other siblings deeply too, but I think even if it's not physically autobiographical, there is this emotional autobiography to everything every writer writes. There's some Jacqueline Woodson and the dad and the brother and Gigi and Sylvia and Angela and August. And then there's a lot that I had to reach for and to understand, because that's another reason I write, because I'm trying to understand.
And one of the things the girls don't understand but have to deal with and realize they have to deal with is the leer of older men in mm-hmm. their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the case across race lines, across economic class, across so many things, is that sense of growing up girl. And what August says in the book is it felt like a bag of stones we had passed among ourselves saying, here, help me carry this. And I think that's because when you grow up girl, your adolescence is very visible, right? Your changing body is very visible. And people, a lot of times men, are watching that. And it's very hard to hide. So I hadn't seen it talked about, even though every girl, woman I know talks about it. And I wanted to bring it to the page and make it be part of the narrative and the conversation.
I was thinking when I was reading about her memories of her childhood, and I said, you know, is this because she's a brilliant person or because she's a woman, she has these deep memories? Because I remember back to my youth, and I was kind of a moron just running around rumping into walls.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, boys mature later, right, I think. And I think there is part of all childhood that's moronic, where we do the craziest things just because we think we're immortal in this way. And I think girls, the way they kind of gather and talk, there's a depth to their ways of being in the world with each other, where boys, that depth, and this is me completely engendering, right? This is not all boys and this is not all girls. But so I want to just be clear about that I don't want to just make this gender pronouncement. My experience of it as a young person is there were certain girls who would bend into each other very intimately and deeply. And there were boys who were, their intimacy came with a physicality. So it was about how they wrestled and played tops and played skelly and existed in the world in that more physical way. And for me as a kid, I traversed those, right? I was sometimes very much with my friends and being that intimate girl, and then I was roughhousing with the boy. So I didn't fit the narrative in that way all the time. And as so, I was able to bear witness to both genders.
And so when August first moves to Brooklyn and sees these trio of girls walking down the street, laughing with their heads thrown back, arm in arm, she is jealous of them in a way because she wants to be with them, but also she resents them because she's not with them.
Yeah, she says, I was beginning to hate them. I was beginning to love them. And I think that we can all relate to that on some level.
But it also goes back to something her mother told her before they left Tennessee, and that women can't be friends with women. You have to keep them at arm's length plus a little extra.
Mm-hmm. Keep them a whole arm's length away from the tip of your fingernail and keep your fingernails long. And so I think it's interesting because I know people who don't have female friends, and that's always surprising to me because of the intimacy of those friendships when so many of us are young, and I have a group of friends who I'm so close with who, you know, everything from help me raise my children, help us raise our children, to help me get through writing a book. And I can't imagine, God forbid, a world where I didn't have that kind of village in my life. And so I was interested in exploring how someone could get to that point of not having their girls. And so I started with the mother giving her this warning, and then seeing how that warning would come to play out.
And it's just that role. How do we deal with the jealousy in our lives? And are we able to tame that, overcome that, and be empathetic and connect with other people?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think jealousy is such a waste of time, because what does it do? I mean, I think the thing that is more productive is drive, right? What is the thing you want most in life, and how are you going to get it? How deeply can you believe in yourself and have that faith in what you want? And who is in the world that's walking beside you? So it's one emotion that I, a long time ago, said that's not going to help me be a better person in the world. But I think when we're young, we don't know this yet, right? And we continue to kind of run in place trying to be like the other, and it's destructive.
Well, I mean, it's that search for status and belonging in a way, too.
What status, though?
I know. There's so many different types of status.
There's always going to be someone richer. There's always going to be someone prettier. There's always going to be someone taller. I remember, you know, I'm the shortest person in my family, and I'm 5'10". And when I was about 15 and realized I was probably not going to grow anymore, I was so mad. I was, you know, I just thought it was so unfair because I wanted to be a basketball player, of course. I thought I was going to be 6'4 like my dad or 6'3 like my brothers. And it was like, this is so wrong. And every time I saw tall girls, I would be so mad at them.
And I really failed to notice the other 85% of women who were shorter than you.
Yeah, I couldn't see them. I mean, they didn't register. The ones that registered were the ones that were taller than I am. But it was. It's like, this is what I have, and this is why I'm grateful for it. And then, of course, I'd see the women who were well over 6 feet slouching. And here they were looking at me as though I wish I could have stopped at 5'10", right? So there's always someone looking at someone with some desire. But at the end of the day, if it's not something that you can achieve, is just going to eat you from the inside out.
And August's father converts to the Nation of Islam in her youth. And unlike so many converts in so many faiths around the world, he's fairly gentle with her in encouraging her to find the path, but not forcing her.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the major themes in the book, is the coming into our parents' backstories, right? So you see Sylvia's dad, who's, you're going to go to college, you're going to become a lawyer, you're going to do this and that. And it was that thing of us becoming our parents' failed dreams for themselves, which is, as a parent, something I think about a lot, right? When I have a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old, and how much of what I'm wanting from them is something that I would have wanted for myself. Because we know that our children, they come through us, but they're not us, right? So we have to step back and let them become who they're becoming. And I think I gave that trait to August's dad, who the Nation of Islam was something he needed for himself. And when the guy stopped him on the street and said, I have a message for you, my beautiful black brother, it was something the dad could hear. And what August heard when the guy looked at her was, your body's a temple, it should be covered. She suddenly felt shame, and that's not a productive emotion or a feeling that one should walk into their religion with. If anything, you're walking into your religion with joy and praise for it. But I wanted the dad to be reflective of that. I also, you know, in terms of our country and Islamophobia, I think people don't understand that Muslims look all kinds of ways and come from all classes, including underserved communities or striving African-American men. It can be a gentle religion, and the people can be gentle, and just like, you know, there can be problematic Christians. I just wanted to add another layer to that dialogue about belief. Walt Whitman said, "Argue not concerning God," and I believe that so deeply.
Her brother followed in the father's footsteps, and he encouraged her when they got back together, but he was not forceful about it.
Exactly.
As you said, Sylvia's family's from Martinique, and her father was big into philosophy, reading Hegel and all the French philosophers. I guess a little Jacques Lacan would be appropriate for the time period. And he was not really approving of her choice of friends. He wanted her to strive.
He did. He was upwardly mobile, right? And he brought his kids over here to this country for better opportunity, the same way that people who came through the Great Migration and immigrants in general came here. And so when he saw this group of scraggly girls that his daughter was hanging with, he's like, what's going on here? And the heartbreaking thing is that in his eyes, the girls saw this new reflection of themselves, which can be dangerous. So I didn't want to put him on the page as a bad guy. He's a caring father and he has dreams for his daughter. But in the end, because your children come through you or come to you, however they come to you, and they're not of you, you only have so much control over them. So in the end, no matter how hard he was bearing down on Sylvia, she was going to make her own choices about who she was becoming.
And August talks about how she really didn't realize her poverty at the time, but one of the first things that when seeing the girls in the schoolyard is knowing, well, I think it was Angela, had a coat that was short, too short in the arms like hers was.
Yeah, and so she says maybe she would understand that we came from the same place, a place where winter comes on quickly, too quickly for our parents to buy us the right length coats. And, you know, I remember that as a kid. I remember it wasn't so much poverty, although there was poverty in Bushwick. And one thing August does is compares herself. She didn't have the hard bones of the really poor kids. But I just remember every year my mother took those coats out of the closet and it was like, boom, you know, half your arm was sticking out of it. And it was the first cold day of winter. And fortunately for me, I had an older sister, so her coat became mine, and she got the new coat, and I was mad. But it was definitely something that, even with my own kids, I always rush to buy them stuff before the season starts because I know how fast they grow. But my mother was young when she had us, and definitely not in the economic place that I'm in. And then there's the constant refrain of Biafra as the place, as what we could have been. The girls, especially August, is this is what our parents are saying, you know, eat your peas, there are children starving in Biafra. And Biafra for her for a long time is this theoretical place in the way that those places are for people that are privileged, right? Because compared to Biafra, she was very privileged because she wasn't starving. Her belly wasn't swollen. So it was something over there. And basically she's like, well, give it to them if they're so hungry. But then when she finally comes across that issue of Life magazine and actually sees these starving children and realizes that this place was real before it melted back into Nigeria, then it becomes clear to her. And again, going back to what I write about, what is tragic isn't the moment, it's the memory. So in that moment, it didn't feel like Biafra was tragic. But then as she got older and she saw those images and they stayed with her and stayed with her to the point where these kids were almost angelic and beatific, she started realizing something else was going on.
And also she realized that her mother had told her the truth. And so she's been telling her brother all these years since they moved to Brooklyn that mommy will join us soon. She will come back to us soon. And so this tension of the truth and denial comes into play there.
Exactly. And I think for a long time, she says in the book, I believed it was so when Sister Sonia says, what she asked her, when did you know your mom was where she was? She's like, today, yesterday, never. Like she hasn't come to terms with it yet. And part of that is also the way young people compartmentalize and hear what they want to hear when they need to hear it, believe what they want to believe, and put the rest somewhere where they can deal with it.
Sister Sonia asked her to kind of take into account other people's suffering around the world and put your own suffering in a bit of perspective in that. And as she grows, you can see that she is not the only one with a burden in her group of friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they're all carrying something. And not only just in her group of friends, but in the world.
Was Sister Sonia named after Sister Sonia Sanchez?
No, it's funny because Sister Sonia Sanchez, I know Sister Sonia Sanchez, and I didn't know she was called Sister Sonia. So she spells it S-O-N-I-A. But when she blurbed the book, I was like, oh my goodness, she's Sister Sonia Sanchez too. I could see her in that role, definitely, except she's not hijabed and Muslim.
Moving on to you. You were named Young People's Poet Laureate by the Poetry Foundation last year. What's the first year of your service been like?
It's been pretty busy. I am talking a lot about poetry. The Poetry Foundation has a website. Each month I post a book and a poem for the month. I'm speaking to a lot of young people about not only the value of poetry, but the access of it, and trying to create this platform where young people know that they have a right to poetry, that poetry is something that's for them, that it's a language we can all speak, that we start speaking it as early as we start speaking. I really want to, in the second year of it, I'm doing even more traveling and traveling to very underserved communities in rural areas where people have never met an author and think they've never met a poet, to basically spread the gospel of poetry. So I'm going into rural Mississippi. I'm going into some parts of Tennessee and Louisiana. I'm going back down south and then to some parts in Appalachia.
So is there any difficulty for you switching gears since you've written this narrative book and going back into the poetry mind to get on these tours with?
No, it's a different kind of research because if I go into, say, Virginia, I want to be able to have poems by poets from Virginia or in Virginia that young people could understand. So there is this level of having to switch gears and go more into the research gear. And I'm not a big fan of research, so that's hard. I think in terms of just talking about the poets I know, the kind of universal poets like Gwendolyn Brooks and Langston Hughes and Robert Frost and even to some extent Shel Silverstein, like that I can do, but I want to be more informed, and that's where the work comes in for me.
Now, do you think with younger readers of poetry, they might respond better to doggerel over something that's more challenging, like a blank verse or some free verse?
I think what I've seen is the thing they respond the most to is rap. You know, anything that I can put a beat behind, and that, so spoken word poetry, and if I throw on, you know, some of the cleaner Tupac, or even taking it back to the day, to the Sugar Hill Gang, and letting them hear this poem through the story. Now, what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat, and me, the groove, and the gang are going to help you move your feet. So, you know, they can hear that, and then they can begin to pick up the rhythms and start writing it.
And are you working on your next book right now?
I am not.
All right. Because I looked at your bibliography, and what, around 30 books in the past 25 years or so? If anyone deserves a break, it is you.
Thank you so much, because I do have some guilt, but I'm like, let it go, Jacqueline, let it go. So I am I want to be mom. We're thinking of moving to Italy from 2017 to 2018, so I'm doing a lot of prep work around getting the looking at schools.
Is it that big fellowship that's over there? Or
it is, but I haven't gotten it. So, that is over there, and it would be awesome to have it, but we'll get there somehow. I just want to spend a year abroad somewhere, and we were thinking France, and now I'm thinking France is not the best place. We go to France every summer, but I'm thinking I want to go someplace maybe just a little bit safer.
What about the Berlin? Isn't there a big fellowship in Berlin too?
There is, but you know, my partner's Jewish, and we struggle around Germany still. So I don't think it'll be Berlin, although I'm going there in March for a week and taking the family.
Well, Jacqueline, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing another Brooklyn with us.
Thanks for reading it and having me.
Jacqueline Woodson is the author of Another Brooklyn, which is available from Amistad. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.